Well, as I said, it is a great pleasure to be here, to listen to so many flattering words. And my special pleasure is that the book that was awarded the Boyai Prize was dedicated to my dear wife, and I also want to dedicate this lecture to her. In fact, the subject of this letter, subject of this lecture is, in a sense, a piece of science fiction. I would like very much it to become real science, but at this particular moment, it is exactly the kind of science that our beloved ones inspire us to. Okay, so there will be a lot of technicalities on the screen, and what I will try to do is to comment upon these technicalities in considerably less technical terms. When I'm speaking about infinities in quantum field theory, what I mean essentially is that in modern quantum field theory, the central protagonist is the so-called Feynman integral. Of course, it depends on a lot of parameters, but what is essential is that there is no general mathematical definition of it. There are several interesting ways to proceed from the intuitive definition to something precise mathematically. And one standard way is to produce a formal series out of it. Unfortunately, this formal series does not converge, and even each term usually does not converge. It is infinite. So the second step is to sort of delete or divide by infinities and to get a finite answer, and this is called renormalization. When I speak about classical computing, infinities in classical computing, I have in mind a totally different story. Namely, classical computing essentially deals, say, with functions that are defined on, say, natural numbers, take natural values, and are defined in such a way that there exists an algorithm to calculate them. But there is a subtle point which usually is not stressed in any computation theoretic discussion. Namely, this algorithm will work finite amount of time and produce a correct answer if and only if the argument where we try to calculate the function belongs to its domain of definition. Otherwise, the algorithm can tell you, no, it's not in the domain, and you are lucky then. Generally, what the algorithm will do, it will work and work and work infinite time and produce nothing at all. And since generally the time of computation can be very, very, very long, you will never know whether you just were did not wait enough time to get the answer, or it is a matter of principle, and at this point the answer doesn't exist. So there are two very different kinds of infinities, and my idea was that if you look closer to the mathematics surrounding these two infinities, it is for mysterious reasons similar in many respects, and I asked myself whether it would be possible to push this similarity further and to produce some mathematically precise scheme that could be applied, say, to classical computation and would work approximately in the same way as it works for renormalization of Feynman integrals. So I will briefly, in the course of this lecture, explain mathematically various notions that should be explained and leave you the judgment about how sound it all is. So the mathematical skeleton of the physical renormalization theory is this. So you write a formal expression for Feynman integral. You represent it as a formal sum over graphs, infinite formal sums over graph. And then you try to calculate each term of this formal sum. It is usually something more or less tractable, but having infinity at the physical values that are interested to you, so you delete the pole, for example. But you want to do it in a way consistent with various intrinsic relations between graphs, like, for example, one graph is a part of another graph. Okay, now, how do graphs appear in computation theory? There are two different ways. One is to imagine that you have some elementary operations that can have inputs and outputs. So you start with some elementary operation applied to some inputs, and you get an input. Well, the story doesn't finish on it. You take this input and put it into another elementary operators, and so on. So you can do it schematically, that is, to write a program for calculation. This will be one graph. Or you can do it step by step, so that you get a graph describing the whole history of computation. These two graphs are very different, and one should keep in mind both of them, but I will not distinguish technically between two of them. Okay, so a few words about how Feynman graphs appear in the renormalization theory. So formally, the idea behind Feynman integral is that you quantize something that you know classically. You have some physical system, and physical system is usually described in two steps. You have some space of local in space and time situations, local in space and time states in which the system can be. And in principle, you at first can imagine that your system moves from your initial condition to your final condition in whatever, say, continuous trajectory it chooses to. But of course, we know that the nature is not made like that. Nature has laws, and in classical physics, these laws are described by differential equations. So among all these possible curves that connect the initial position to the final position, differential equations choose one, this trajectory. Now, quantization of this picture starts with a similar idea that there is infinitely many possible ways from one state to another state, but then each such possible ways is ascribed an amplitude, a complex number, which is exponential of I multiplied by action along this trajectory. And then you somehow try to sum all these things over all trajectories. So you should imagine an integral over an infinite dimensional space of trajectories. And and then the result that you get is not one trajectory, but a kind of probability, actually kind of square root of probability, is that system that started at position zero will finish at position infinity. And this probability is expressed by this awful and remarkable and exciting Feynman integral. Now, to start to do mathematics out of it, right now it's just a character, a hieroglyph. It's nothing mathematically defined, this 1-1 formula that you see on the screen. Well, you make some very simplifying and algebraic instead of physical condition. You imagine that instead your space of path, you have just finite dimensional Euclidean space. Then you imagine that your action S of phi is, so phi is an element, a vector in the finite dimensional Euclidean space, so it has a quadratic part, the so-called corresponding to free system, and it has a non-quadratic part, which I will express as a formal series again. So it has infinitely many coefficients. And so the coefficients G, A, B, and C that you see here, it's kind of a moduli space of physical theories in this very schematic, very simple algebraic way. If you then write down this integral, it still has no sense, But there is now a well-defined prescription that tells you how to replace, I'm writing equality 1.3, but actually it's a quality definition. The right-hand side is obtained in the following way. You consider formal series under the sign of integral, you interpret it using Gaussian integrals, then you calculate them, and then you get a formal series at the right-hand side. This is the formal series of perturbation theory in a very elementary version. And the summation is over graphs, which I denote by tau. Okay. Now, some explanations. How do you visualize graphs? Okay. What I am presenting you is a picture, of course, but I try to present this picture as concocted out of elementary components so that it's not just an illustrative picture, but something that can be formalized in the future theory. Namely, I look at first at each vertex of this graph, and I imagine that probably it's kind of vertex where several elementary particles get together and then something happens to them and then other elementary particles get out of this. And so these one vertex graphs are sort of elementary constituents. Then you take several such elementary constituents and then you say that one input from one graph becomes output in another graph, and one input in one more graph becomes output in another graph, or otherwise output becomes input. But also it can happen that there are loops, so something that was two inputs in one graph are getting together. Also, in physics, implicitly I'm saying that in physics there is time, so these graphs are oriented. So when you imagine them as Feynman graphs, then you know in what direction along this graph these particles move. Okay? And then finally, when I'm writing a concrete series, I must calculate what expression corresponds to a given graph. And this expression, of course, depends on the physical model that I have chosen from the very beginning. And it is a polynomial in those letters G and C that were introduced at the very beginning and that characterize a given formal physical theory through its action. So to summarize, we consider all graphs of this type. Their vertices are marked by certain expressions, polynomials of coefficients C and G. And then we sum over such expressions and we get this formal series. Okay, now how does one do the renormalization? First of all, I'm explaining now because I do not want to continue drawing just pictures without making precise algebraic sense of it. I explain how I replace these pictures by a mathematical structure which is called combinatorial graph and for which the actual graph is geometric realization. But I'm just explaining here notation. So you have vertices. At each vertices there are several flags or halves of edges, and then there are certain labels and things like that. And then there is orientation. Now, at this point, I can pass to a notion which is essential for computation theory. If I have such an abstract graph, then I can reinterpret it, not in quantum field theory, but in the theory of computation by using the notion of abstract flow chart. So I take the same graph and now I decorate its vertices by a set of names of operations. And I'm imagining that inputs are some variable values that to which these operations can be applied, and that the outputs are one or several results that can be obtained by applying this operation. Okay. And now what is very essential is this. As I said, in quantum field theory, whenever one concocts a mathematical expression corresponding to a given graph in Feynman theory, one again gets an infinity. Essentially, one gets a finite dimensional, in some easiest cases, one gets a finite dimensional integral, but it diverges. So you should imagine that it depends on certain parameters, and it diverges at physical values of these parameters. But otherwise, it not necessarily diverges. It can be even an analytic function only having poles or something like that at physical values of the parameters. So imagine something like that. And then you say, okay, I want to extract a finite part of this infinite expression, and I want to, for example, to do it by deleting the pole part. But this is a prescription that refers only to each specific graph. And we know that both physically and computationally, when one part when one graph is a part of another graph, then it means that it produces its outputs that become inputs of another graph, and there were infinities when you have been calculating this part, and then there will be new infinities out there. So we should not imagine that we can do this procedure of extracting infinities separately for each graph. You should somehow do it in a way that is consistent with the whole universe of graphs that are relevant for a given theory. And there are several formal mathematical prescriptions. Considerable part of them goes back to the remarkable work of Bogoliubov and his school in the 50s and 60s. And the precise version I am using here is called nowadays the Kohn-Kreimer-Hopf algebra of flow charts. And essentially, the mathematical details that needed to present this Hopf algebras is based upon a very simple notion. Mathematically, if you have a graph, you can cut it. Just cut several edges in the half, and then you get, since it is oriented, you get the upper part of the graph and the lower part of the graph. You can do cuts in various different ways. And in quantum field theory, of course, it's kind of, you stop the physical process at a certain moment of time, and then you start it again the same moment of time, so you consider what happened before and what will be happening after. Not quite so, but approximately. Okay. Computation theory, if you imagine the graph of a computation, well, okay, you can do cuts, and you can see them on this picture. They are just short segments crossing the arrows in this picture. And in boxes, you see the operations that can be made upon inputs of each elementary operation. Okay, so this is a formal definition, doesn't pay many attention to it. What is essential is that we are considering not just one flow chart of one computation, but the whole class of them, which should be closed with respect to the fact, with respect to the natural operation, namely, if you make a cut in this graph, and if it was an admissible history of computation, then the upper half and the lower half of the cards are also histories of computations, and also each connected component, if there are such. Okay. And mathematics start, algebra starts when we then produce out of a given admissible system of graphs, we produce something that is called the bi-algebra, and later it becomes even Hopf algebra. So it has multiplication and dual operation of co-multiplication. Multiplication just simply... So this algebra is linearly generated by isomorphism classes of your graphs, and multiplication is just corresponds to the disconnected union of two graphs. This is very easy. And co-multiplication is a little bit more complicated. Namely, you cut this graph in all possible ways and then multiply upper half by lower half of the graph and then sum over all these results. So you will get a Hopf algebra. You will get a Hopf algebra. This is easy. So it is not Hopf algebra, it's a commutative bi-algebra with unit formally speaking. To make out of it the Hopf algebra, and the difference between algebra and Hopf algebra is approximately as follows. Bi-algebra and Hopf algebra is approximately as follows. If you imagine your bi-algebra and imagine that as algebra, forgetting co-multiplication, it's algebra of functions on a certain space, then co-multiplication makes out of this space a semigroup. You can multiply points of this space. And Hopf algebra, if it is Hopf algebra, it tells you that this semigroup is actually a group. And you can do is... that is to show that such a bi-algebra of flow charts is actually a Hopf algebra, so it's morally something like an algebra of functions over a group, if it has a canonical structure that if there is an appropriate grading of this subalgebra satisfying the condition that this bi-algebra satisfying the conditions that are written here. Forget about them. What I would like you to imagine is that so we started in quantum field theory with something that was a hieroglyph, a character of something very definite integral expression, so to speak. But then we couldn't make sense of it directly, so we produced out of it a formal series. But now we want to return somehow integrity to this formal series. And to return integrity, we input it, we construct out of it something like a group. You don't see the group itself, but you see the Hopf algebra that represents this group and that encodes simultaneously the ways to either take your Feynman graph and represent it as a union of time histories of two different processes or take your graph and represent it as an iteration of two different computational processes. So there is some kind, but you do it simultaneously for all possibilities that are inherent in your formalization. Okay. Now, as I said, we should expect that then we produce out of each term of series or out of each computation something which is generally or can be infinite. And so we somehow want to get rid of these infinities. So we need a parameter such that for generic values of this parameter, you get an actual thing, an actual finite thing, but you are interested in such specific values of this parameter for which you get infinity. So I'm introducing this parameter. I call it formally z. And I imagine that from each graph I can construct a meromorphic function of z. It should be meromorphic and determined around z equals to zero, but actually can have a pole at z equals to zero. So z is some extra parameter. It's not something real, but there are serious physical and mathematical reasons to introduce it. Okay. doesn't want to get to continue. It stops on page 22. It stops on page 22, and it doesn't go further on. Oh, yeah, finally. Finally. Okay. So I can, for the time being, imagine some kind of this Hopf algebra as I defined above, and axiomatize everything approximately as follows. That, so I have this Hopf algebra, and I have a map that produces out of each graph some analytic function of a parameter. Maybe this parameter was not initially in the theory. And at the physical value of this parameter, z equals to zero, you get some infinities. And so how do I extract or divide by this infinity uniformly for all values of this parameter? And this will be the so-called Birkhoff decomposition. Approximately, again, I don't want to enter into technicalities, but approximately as follows. If you have a function that has a pole at z equal zero, so it's something like a constant divided by zero plus another constant divided by z square and so on, a finite number of steps, and the remaining part is regular at zero. So I just can delete the pole part. But if I'm considering everything together, then I do not delete, but I divide. In this non-commutative group that is represented by my Hopf algebra, I divide by the pole part instead of deleting it. That's essentially the meaning of this Birkhoff decomposition. Okay. And now I want to, so I have explained the origin of this procedure in Feynman integrals. Then I explain the general scheme of how this procedure acts. And now I want to explain briefly how do you apply this story, how do you apply this story to algorithms of computation. There is a very naive way to, very naive but also very practical and probably the only one which is used practically, way to get rid of infinite time of computations in real computations. Actually, you should get rid, of course, not only of infinite time of computation, but generally if your computer got stuck on a certain input for too long, you don't want to consider this input or just wait for an hour or so and then said, okay, now let's get to the second value and so on. Of course, you should do it in a reasonable way. Yes, being a mathematician, you should lay down first what you are expected to get after you have taken this decision. So you get some answer, but you have no idea whether it's correct one or not, or how long you should wait, and things like that. So the mathematical way in theoretical computing is embodied in the notion of any-time algorithms, and that essentially means that you first of all decide how long you will be waiting, and then you devise a mathematical scheme telling you how good is your result even if you did not actually wait long enough. And a nice cutoff argument that was invented by Kalud and Stay is something like that. The argument of Kalud and Stay tells you that on sort of speak sufficiently sufficiently random arguments, it suffices to wait at a point x, it suffices to wait approximately x square units of time. If you don't get the result before that, then probably it's not defined at this point. Most probably, this probability 1 in a sense. This is all based on the notion of Kolmogorov complexity, which is too complicated to explain it here. So I can prove a more general version of Kalut state theorem. But generically, I want you to imagine the following story. So you have in the initial theory of computation the domain which consists, say, of natural numbers. But even intuitively, we know that not all natural numbers are, well, not equal, of course, they are not equal, but not all of them are so natural. For example, usually when one speaks about national debt or state debt or something, one says, okay, $5 trillion or $14 trillion. Probably it's not trillions, probably it's something consisting of nine or whatever number of digits there are, much more precise. No, one forgets about them and just inputs zero. Why? Well, because $14 trillion is Kolmogorov, very simple number, whereas if you put a lot of ones, twos, threes, and so on digits instead of the zeros, you will usually get something much more complicated, but for our purposes, not much more useful. So to understand Kolmogorov complexity, you should imagine that actually we are using only numbers that can be expressed in a brief way. If anything can be expressed only in a very long way, if anything has only very long programs to calculate it, then probably we'll simply not use them. So imagine the history of humanity, and imagine all numbers that have been written by somebody somewhere and so on. Imagine them and put them in a row. You will see that there will be big gaps. Nobody ever probably used something like 27914000011. It doesn't. These big gaps will correspond mostly to something which has properties of random numbers. That's very interesting. That was a great insight of Kolmogorov that connected the theory of computation with probability theory. And actually, when I was trying to understand whether I can use regularization, renormalization, whether I can use it in computation theory, of course, I immediately found out that if I hope to do it, I must use Kolmogorov complexity. This is very briefly how I tried to do it. So, as I said, the basic kind of infinity that appears in the theory of computation is the infinity of time of computation if you stumbled upon a point which is not in the domain of definition of your computable function, partially computable function. As I said, in the renormalization procedure, you should introduce a parameter, an artificial parameter, so to speak, in order to be able to produce out of it a kind of Hopf algebra that will be used for this computation. And therefore, when I have a program, I must somehow imagine that I'm calculating not just one value at one integer, but some kind of analytic function of z. And so how can I do that? I got stuck on it, but then I found out that a very nice exit, a very nice way to proceed was already found in the theory of quantum computing. Only in the theory of quantum computing, it was applied to calculation of function defined on finite domains and taking only finite number of values. The problem there was, for mathematically minded listeners, the problem was that in quantum computing, in principle, one can calculate only unitary operators. So unitary operators in a finite dimensional space corresponds not to an arbitrary function, but only to permutations. Whereas even function which is identically one everywhere is not a permutation. So how does one produce from an arbitrary function of this type a permutation? Well, the idea was that you change this function, you keep in the notation not only the values but also the arguments, and then one can concoct a very simple algebraic procedure that reduces calculation of anything to a calculation of permutation. It turns out that it works also in the infinite dimensional case, so that was the lesson that pleased me very much. And so instead of computing, instead of dealing with values of arguments upon which the function is not determined, I will be now dealing with those values of arguments upon which function takes the same value as an argument, which upon which it is identical, this function. And it turns out that I can calculate, that I can produce an analytic function that has exactly the behavior required in the application of renormalization procedure in physics. I can calculate it if I explicitly take the Kolmogorov complexity, or better, the Kolmogorov order of n. It is not a computable function either, but since I am in non-computable domain anyway, I can allow this myself. And also it is a matter of principle. Dealing with uncomputability, I must not shy away of non-computable things. And so finally I can produce the character of Kramer-Kohn Hopf algebra corresponding to a given partially recursive function. This is an explicit expression for it that behaves exactly as it should in the physical situation. It has poles. It has a pole at the boundary exactly when I have a fixed point of my function. Well, my time is over, so I'll stop here. And this is a small list of references. And if there are any questions, I can try to address them.